let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, understand something. It is Scintillating Science Monday, and you know how I love to have the scientists on to make up for my dismal science education growing up. I get to talk to actual scientists who actually make the effort to make things understandable. So here to scintillate you with his sparkling scientific wit, I'd like to welcome Kevin Aris. Hello.
Hey, Marilyn. How's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing good.
All right. Well, we're going to first start out with, when did you first discover that you were interested in the sciences?
Well, that goes pretty far back. I virtually can't remember a time where I wasn't interested in science. What sort of happened over time was I got focused on what particular area of science I wanted to pursue, because when I was a kid, I was sort of immediately really interested in natural wildlife, mm-hmm. animals, plants, etc. I spent a lot of time outside, and both my parents have a lot of science background and are both naturalists, so I was sort of like exposed for basically as long as I can remember to like what's really awesome about plants and animals. And then mm-hmm. as I got older, I got sort of more interested in more nitty gritty math stuff.
Well, I want to go back to, so you're like a super little kid, make 3 or 4, and they're taking you around and they're pointing out stuff, or did they notice that you had a natural aptitude for it, or how did that unfold that they kind of tricked you into loving science?
It kind of unfolded very naturally. I think I had a natural aptitude for it as well as the early exposure. So, and yeah, what you said is exactly right. Starting when I was really, really young, mm-hmm. when we'd go to the beach. So I grew up in Florida, so we'd spend a lot of time at the beach and at, springs, swamps, et cetera, that were nearby, mm-hmm. and doing a fair amount of hiking in the area. And my parents would walk me through local wildlife that they knew. In particular, my mother, who had done some zoology in Florida when mm-hmm. she was in her 20s, so she knew a lot about what was going on in those ecosystems. And mm-hmm. I was sort of immediately turned on to how fascinating all of that was. And I got really into shows on Discovery Channel, mm-hmm. Animal Planet, all that kind of stuff when I was like a toddler and a teen.
Wow. So I'm guessing you never went through like a rebellious stage where you're like, science, that's what my parents do.
No. If I went through a rebellious stage, it was not against science.
Okay. Well, we won't go into that because that's for you to know and the law to never find out. But so you are doing sciences, and then you go off to college, and do you start directly into the sciences, or do you make a circuitous route to the science that you want to do?
No, I started directly in it. I started as a major in physics in college.
Mm-hmm.
And then about halfway through, I added a major in biology.
Okay.
Because I was really interested in both. Mm-hmm. And I was doing research in physics for the vast majority of my undergrad as well.
Okay. So were you able to figure out a way to meld the two? Because, you know, I know physics is the physical, you know, the realm of movement, but, you know, you have your quantum physics and all of that. And then you have actual animals who exist in the world where we can see them.
Yeah, actually, what sort of caused me to add the biology major is I was actually extremely interested in the intersection of, like, physics and biology and chemistry.
Oh, okay.
And so I remember there was only one, so I'm currently a PhD student in biophysics at Stanford.
Okay.
And there was only one course taught about biophysics at the University of Florida in the physics department. And I remember just immediately being turned on to the subject because it really was taking a lot of the physical principles I knew from my courses mm-hmm. and applying it to cell biology and all sorts of interesting molecular mechanisms. And, you know, those sort of very nitty-gritty physics subjects like quantum physics and statistical mechanics, all of these sort of fancy terms,
mm-hmm.
I never really got turned onto those in like a career sense, because I could not really wrap my head around how it applies to everyday life.
Sure.
Despite my fascination with it sort of on an intrinsic level.
Uh-huh.
And so like getting to like apply the physical principles I knew to biology, which definitely has immediate consequences for people's life when you look at what comes out of the research, I was like really interested in combining the disciplines and learning more and more about how to do that.
Well, give me some examples of how physics and biology through your studies, how they intersect and interact.
Oh, yeah. So, for example, in biology, what happens a lot is a particular molecule will bind to another particular molecule inside of a cell.
Okay.
And using the physical principles outlined in statistical mechanics, which is often used to describe how gases interact with each other at different temperatures,
okay,
you can actually use the same principles to describe what the probability is that a particular molecule will bind to another molecule at certain concentrations inside of the cells in your body, which is really important for how fast the reaction will proceed and at what efficiency that reaction will proceed. And so that's sort of one sort of simple example of like how you can apply like physical principles to like cellular biology.
What is the application of knowing how fast something binds to something else in everyday life?
Oh, yeah, so that has direct applications to things like drug design. So
okay,
when you might be designing a molecule
mm-hmm.
that needs to bind to another molecule at some rate, or it needs to outcompete molecules that already exist in your cells. So drugs will often bind to the same places as other molecules in your body, like endogenous molecules, molecules that are already there.
Okay.
And if you're designing a drug, you want it to be able to bind well, quickly, and it needs to be able to outcompete the things that already bind to those receptors in your body. So by like understanding the physical principles of how molecules bind to other molecules, you can have a better understanding for design principles for new drugs. For new drugs, yeah.
Okay, so, but you're not studying drugs, are you?
I do not personally study drugs.
No. Okay, that's one type of example. Like, you would use that in trying to design a drug to say, not cure cancer, but maybe as like a antiviral?
Yeah, antivirals, antibacterial drugs, or drugs that are associated with, you know, metabolic disorders or things like that. Sort of, you can imagine that the way we would design small molecule drugs is fairly, at its basic level, fairly similar across fields, where you have to optimize the structure of the drug
mm-hmm.
such that it fits into whatever receptor it needs to fit into.
Okay, okay. So that's just, you know, I'm at the edges of my comprehension, so but I'm still within the comprehension. So you found how they overlap, but there's only one class. So how do you build a not a career, but a, I don't know what the word is, but how do you go from there if there's only one class to take?
So I was lucky, and that class did a really nice, I really loved the professor I had for that course, and he did a really nice overview of like a myriad of applications of biophysics.
Okay.
And one of the applications he went over was the physics of DNA, and that's the one I kind of attached to the most in the class and I remember best, and that is sort of most adjacent to what I work on now.
Okay.
And so I got really interested in how much DNA you have in your body and how it acts as a code. You know, when we are in school, DNA is often sort of portrayed to us as just a sequence of letters.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is like a physical object inside of your cells. And it turns out that the way that your body physically manipulates the DNA in every single one of your cells is basically just as important as the letters in that code. And so I got really interested in learning how sort of the physical aspects of the DNA code affect how your body manipulates it and uses it.
Okay, now I have a question that's probably dumb, but you can just pretend that it isn't, which is, so we have all of these, like we have our skin cells, the cells that make up our hair and our heart and everything. Does every single cell in my body and every single cell in your body have identical DNA?
Yes. The genetic code inside of all of your body is the same. What causes cells to be different is what parts of the genome are expressed in those cells.
Okay, so you have this long sequence, maybe thousands of letters, and how does it express itself? Is it like everything else is grayed out and then one part is bolded, or like is it a chemical that turns it on? What makes it work?
Yeah, actually, what you just said is a fairly good metaphor for some of it being like bolded and some of it being grayed out.
Mm-hmm.
In different cells in your body, you'll have different regions of the genome that are programmed to be expressed more to fit the functions of that particular region. What
causes it? What makes this part be bolded over here for your skin, and this part be bolded over here for your pancreas, and this part over here be bolded for your eyelashes?
I'm not going to probably give this answer as well as I could, because I'm not super well versed in cell biology these days, but basically what happens is when your body is developing and your cells are differentiating,
mm-hmm.
they're sort of, during the differentiation process, they're given some set of signals that tell them, express this here, express this there. And at that moment, when they're differentiating into the different parts of your body, once they start dividing from there, they know already which proteins and which parts of the genome that they need to express to become those cells. If my father's listening to this, he's probably thinking that I should be giving much more details.
And that's all happening before you're born or throughout your whole life?
A lot of that happens when you are in the process of developing.
Okay.
But it continues to happen in our bodies throughout our lifetime. Cells continue to differentiate into those different types of cells in most cases.
And assuming that there's no, major catastrophe, radiation exposure or anything like that, are there times when the cells go haywire, like the DNA just starts being different?
Absolutely, yeah. So basically all of the machinery that you have in your cells that replicates the genome and that transcribes the genome, all of that has some inherent error rate. Now, that error rate is quite low.
Mm-hmm.
So in the vast majority of cases, it doesn't cause a problem. But even without things like radiation, sun damage, or like chemicals, their errors can be put into the genome just intrinsically, because the processes in your cells are not perfect.
But that is localized, yes? It doesn't just suddenly happen to your whole body. It's like, your foot is doing something weird.
Yeah, it would be localized to a particular cell. And in most cases, if a mutation is like highly deleterious, that cell will either kill itself or will be killed by your immune system.
Nice. Okay. All right. So I know we have drifted kind of away from what you study. So what is it that you are studying right now?
So I currently study how CRISPR enzymes, so CRISPR is sort of a hot topic in biology right now.
Mm-hmm.
I study how the enzymes associated with the CRISPR mechanism of gene editing, like how those, figuring out the best way to phrase this. I want to understand how the physical state of DNA affects how those enzymes interact with DNA. So to step back a little bit, CRISPR-Cas enzymes, what they do is that they can be programmed with a particular sequence. And then what those Cas enzymes can do is find a matching sequence in the genome of your cells, of a bacterial cell, of whatever cell you put them into. And when they find a sequence that matches the sequence they've been loaded with,
mm-hmm.
they will bind to the DNA and cleave the DNA. And so what I am really interested in going back to what I said about sort of the physical nature of DNA, is that I'm really interested in how inside of your body, your DNA is being twisted on and it's being pulled on and it's sort of all knotted up mm-hmm. inside of the nucleus of your cells.
Okay.
And I'm really interested in how that physical deformation of the DNA affects the ability of Cas enzymes to bind to and cleave that DNA.
Well, I have a lot of questions, but before I do that, I want, for our listening audience, I know CRISPR is a hot topic, but there are probably a lot of people who really don't know what CRISPR is. They've seen the word, but they didn't. So what is CRISPR for the uninitiated?
Oh, yeah. So CRISPR actually originates. The term is an acronym for something that is extremely difficult to understand, so I'll just describe what it is.
Okay.
So inside of bacteria cells, there is an innate immunity system. So in our bodies, we have an immune system that actually remembers what we've been previously infected with, and that's through antibodies.
Okay.
Right? We have antibodies that remember previous infection.
Okay.
In a bacterial cell, the way they remember previous infection is different. And the CRISPR comes from actually this bacterial immune system, where what happens is when a bacterial cell is infected by a virus, mm-hmm. it actually takes a section of the genome of the virus and integrates that section into its own genome.
Okay.
And then when the bacterial cell is infected again by the same virus,
mm-hmm.
it actually transcribes that little bit of the genome that it pulled out of that virus,
mm-hmm.
and it loads it into a Cas protein. And then that Cas protein finds the matching sequence in the invading virus
mm-hmm.
and cleaves up the virus, thereby mitigating the infection of the virus.
So it just
hacks
it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And that hacking up just neutralizes the virus, and the virus can't infect you.
Exactly.
Okay, so with the that's in the bacterial cell. What are its applications, or how do you use what you've learned about that bacteria to make it work in other areas?
Yes. So what we can do is we can find the sequence of the genome that is associated with Cas proteins, and what we can do is we can actually put those Cas proteins with these loaded, so I've been talking about these sequences they're loaded with. These are called guide RNAs. And the reason that's because they guide the sequence of the RNA is a guide to the DNA sequence that it matches and cleaves.
Okay.
And what we can do is in any cell, we can add Cas protein. We can add guide RNAs that target a particular sequence that we're interested in cleaving or blocking.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can just do that in those cells. So we can express Cas proteins in those cells or put Cas proteins in those cells, load them up with those guide RNAs, and then that whole system works regardless of the environment, even outside of those. So the CRISPR system originates as this bacterial immune system,
mm-hmm.
but we can actually sort of take it out of that context and use it in a whole bunch of other contexts by just putting the system together in a bunch of places.
So I have heard that there was a scientist, I believe in China, who used CRISPR to sort of make a designer baby. I know that's a wild simplification of it. But with that, what are all the things you can do with CRISPR? And in your opinion, what things are the great things that they're doing, and what things merit a deep ethical examination?
So to start with, what that person did needs a deep ethical examination.
Uh-huh.
I believe that person went to prison.
But they're out now.
Are they out now? I have not kept up with the details. I know that they were at a minimum highly ridiculed by their scientific peers and hopefully went to prison for at least some amount of time.
Yeah, they're out now and starting up a new lab, and people are like, I don't think you should be doing this. And he's like, I don't care.
Oh, okay. That is highly unfortunate, because that person should probably not be allowed to enter the scientific field again after doing what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that sort of stuff requires a lot of ethical consideration, especially on the human side. Now, what's really cool is that we can test this system in a lot of really interesting ways before we start doing this quote-unquote designer baby thing,
mm-hmm.
because that is sort of far down the future, like when we've developed this technology better. And so one of the cool things that's being done right now, like frequently, is crop development. So what you can do is before even like trying this out on humans, you can try this out on our crops. And actually CRISPR has been used in a huge number of experiments trying to sort of modify things like rice, tomatoes, I think maybe potatoes. I've seen a lot of papers where basically scientists are using CRISPR technology in crops to try to make yields higher or make mm-hmm. them more resistant to pesticides or to bugs, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting applications in food. And on the disease side, there are some really promising clinical trials of using CRISPR to treat certain mutation-borne diseases. So a lot of diseases in the human body can be caused by just a single site mutation. And what that means is there's only one base in your 6.5 billion base pairs of genes. There's only one base that's incorrect, but that base causes a huge problem in a lot of people. And that can be some forms of muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis. A lot of cancers are caused by single point mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of cool clinical trials recently indicating that you can use CRISPR as a really promising way to treat some of those diseases.
Okay, so when you talk about those diseases and the single point, does that mean that you would be able to, down the future, detect that single point in a fetus or in a newborn?
Yeah, I think so. I think down the line that detecting the single point mutation actually isn't that hard. We can sequencing the human genome 20 years ago was like a $1 billion project.
Mm-hmm.
And these days that's been reduced by many orders of magnitude. So sequencing a genome actually isn't that hard these days.
What caused it to drop in price? Was it just like the iPhone or something?
a huge amount of technological advances. So there's like a huge amount of money in research associated with bringing down that cost has been invested over the last 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now we have things like, right, you can pay to send your genome to like Ancestry.com and all these things, right? The technology is so available that it's starting to be used sort of like recreationally just so people can learn about their lineages.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so like there's just been a huge amount of technological advances, like literally machines being made that can take genomic samples, chop them up, sequence them. There's a lot of computation involved with taking, 6.5 billion bases and ordering them and sequencing them.
Mm-hmm.
And our computers, as virtually everyone knows, have gotten much, much better over the last 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the computational capacity that we have is so much higher than it was 20 years ago, that being able to align all those sequences and put them together has become much less of a task technologically.
So in a person who has that one base that has gone off, but as you said earlier, that's every last cell in your body, then how does CRISPR target every cell?
Well, actually, hopefully, a lot of diseases actually only affect a specific type of cell in your body. So take something like a cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Which might be caused by a single point mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Those only affect like cells in your heart.
Okay.
So what we would have to do is find ways to target the CRISPR to your heart. And that is already, like, we already have methods. I'm not familiar with them because I'm not a drug designer.
Right,
we already have methods that we can design drugs and pills to only target certain subsections of your body by having them be released under only certain circumstances or only received by certain types of receptors that are expressed only on one type of cell.
So it's okay for the flawed sequence to be present in all of the other cells that are grayed out, as we talked about, as long as you're targeting the ones in the bolded areas?
Yeah, right. So imagine you have a deleterious mutation that causes issues in your heart, but those cells are in your skin. Okay. If that deleterious mutation stays in your skin, it has no effect because the gene associated with it probably isn't being expressed.
Okay.
But so it doesn't have it. So as long as you target the area where the error is causing a problem, then it should be okay.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Kevin Aris, who is going for your PhD. And have you started your thesis yet?
I will be starting to write my thesis probably this summer. I'm just ending my sixth year, so I am hopefully on the road to graduating fairly soon.
Excellent, excellent. Now, when I look at your description, it says you use high-resolution microscopy techniques to do single-molecule experiments with CRISPR endonucleases. And I can say all those words, but I don't actually know what that means.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So we use these really cool methods. I was really drawn to these methods because of my physics background.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do in my lab is we use something called magnetic tweezers. And what we can do with these, I'm going to try my best to describe this without pictures. Pictures always help with this.
Okay.
So what we can do is we can take a single strand of DNA.
All right.
And we do this in a completely non-cellular context. So this is all what's called in vitro.
Okay.
So there are no cells involved in the experiments that I do. So what we can do is we can take a single strand of DNA, and we can actually attach that single strand of DNA to a glass slide,
mm-hmm.
and then we can attach the other end of that strand of DNA to a little magnetic bead, so this little magnetic particle.
Okay.
And we can, using a particular formulation of magnets above the microscope, we can actually pull on that little magnetic bead such that we apply tension to a single strand of DNA. And then we can also twist that little magnetic particle so that we can apply like torque or twist to a single strand of DNA. So what we're trying to do with these types of like microscopy setups is take the DNA out of the super complicated context that is the cell, where tons of stuff is interacting with it, mm-hmm. and doing stuff with it. And I want to just look at how a single molecule of Cas9 or Cas12, which are two CRISPR-Cas enzymes, I want to watch a single one of those bind to a single molecule of DNA,
mm-hmm.
and observe that interaction at I want to observe that interaction without the interference of everything else going on in the cell. So we have these sophisticated microscopy setups where we can look at single molecules of Cas enzymes bind to single molecules of DNA and very, very meticulously, like biophysically characterize,
mm-hmm.
That interaction between those two molecules.
Okay, so then I have a question. So you're looking through this microscope. So now the strand of DNA actually is enlarged through the microscope, but we're still talking about how long of a strand of letters is that?
So the one in my experiments, it's about 6,000,
okay,
which amounts to a few hundred nanometers or so of DNA. And what's interesting is actually what we're seeing is not the DNA itself. The DNA is too thin, so DNA is only a couple of nanometers across.
Okay.
So it's actually too thin to see with the light of the microscope. But what we do with our microscopy setup is we attach beads to different points on the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
We, like I said, we have that magnetic bead, but we also can attach beads to the side of the DNA. And those beads are readily visible on the microscope because the beads can be something like 100 nanometers across.
Okay.
And what we can do is we can use the motion of that bead as a proxy for understanding what's going on structurally in the DNA. So the bead will move in a specific way when the Cas enzyme binds to the DNA, the bead will move in a particular way that is indicative of that interaction.
So given that the strand of DNA is like 6,000 letters long, and it's way skinny and it's way tiny, and you're using these beads, how do you know what you're targeting?
So we we completely designed that 6,000 bass pairs. So I can go in and I can make single bass pair edits to that. And then what's really, really awesome about technology these days is that I can just tell a company, hey, I want this sequence of DNA, and they will just send it to me.
What?
And so I can, these DNA sequences are completely designed by me and other people in the lab, and we can basically, it's very modular, so the DNA comes in sections, so we can generate these pieces to have precisely the sequence that we want, so that there's only like one place for the Cas to bind, so that we know that it's not having a bunch of interactions that it's not supposed to.
Okay, so I know I'm probably getting caught up in the weeds, but when you say you're designing this, or someone is designing this, you're saying, I don't know what the letters are, the four letters are, but I want it to be blah, 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 blah. And they just go, okay, but how does that help you if it doesn't exist in the real world, if it's just sort of an imaginary piece of DNA?
So the specific piece of DNA that we're using probably does not exist in a cell somewhere. It might, because there is so much DNA in so many cells that there's probably something fairly similar if you look across tons and tons of species. But the part that we're focused on is like the physical characterization of this interaction. And that characterization should be the same regardless of context, regardless of the sequence of the surrounding DNA. What should matter is only that binding sequence of the Cas enzyme to this strand of DNA. So if you find that same binding sequence in a cell, the fact that it's flanked by a sequence that isn't the same as the sequence that I'm using should not affect how it interacts physically with that DNA. So to sort of put that in other terms, I realize that sort of difficult to understand.
We're
applying a certain amount of tension and twist to this DNA strand. If you find a binding sequence inside of a cell that is under identical physical manipulation, where it's been twisted and pulled on by cellular machinery in a similar way, regardless of the sequence that's flanking that, the physical interaction should be the same inside of a cell. So
I think I understand. So you're saying that that bead is designed to only target this particular sequence, like when you're trying to put a puzzle together, it will only fit this, and it doesn't matter what's on either side of it, because it's geared to find whatever accepts this.
Exactly. So, but we perform this physical characterization, and this is fairly common in biology, especially these days with these really nice microscopy methods that are in vitro, where we have all these cool assays we can do outside of cells. Mm-hmm. It's really, really hard to perform these measurements inside of a cell because so much is going on.
Okay.
And so what we have to do is we have to reduce the system by taking it a bit out of context.
Sure.
But the physical principles that we measure and that we calculate and model outside of the cell should apply inside of the cell in theory.
In theory,
and
okay.
What we basically, what's the idea behind the science like this is that you take a particular interaction inside of a cell, you remove it from the cellular context, and you perform high resolution measurements on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back to the cell and you see if the model you constructed in your non-cellular context applies well in your cellular context. And so that would be like the next step
from the research
that I'm currently doing. Like, right, we're building models that are supposed to describe how these enzymes interact with DNA that's been physically deformed.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step would be find a place in a cell that matches that physical deformity and see how the enzymes interact with that portion of the cell.
Okay. So then, like you're saying, you're sort of working, you're building these models, but is it a possibility that when you get into sort of the real world DNA and you plug that that key into the DNA port, that is it possible that the surrounding things could have an effect on it, the way, like, if you were walking across a drawbridge and the water was filled, or instead of water, there was, like, acid. If it splashes on you, it's going to harm you. Is there that possibility that the context of where that piece of DNA resides could affect how it interacts with that piece that you've created?
Absolutely. We would expect that the model does not perfectly describe the behavior inside of a cell. What it does is it gives us a really good starting point for expectations inside of a cell,
okay,
and understanding some of the behavior that we currently can't explain inside of cells. So what's interesting is that Cas enzymes inside of cells will bind to different regions of the genome with different efficiency. Mm-hmm. They'll cleave different genomes of the different regions of the genome with different efficiency. And inside of a cell, it's really difficult to figure out exactly why those different regions have different amounts of activity. And so by building models in non-cellular contexts like the experiments that I do, mm-hmm, we can sort of try to piece together. And right, there are people building models using these types of experiments all over the world. And by sort of piecing together the results from all of these different experiments that are done outside of cells, we can try to come up with really good descriptions of why what we're seeing in cells is possible. Because it's sort of difficult to just look at the cellular data and totally understand why all of that is happening.
Okay. Now, when you are out and about in the world and you run across kids, what do you tell them? How do you describe what you do in a way that is accessible?
I try to come at, especially with kids, I sort of avoid the talk of the sophisticated microscopy techniques, admittedly.
Okay.
I try to come at it from a sort of a different perspective that involves some really cool big numbers and facts, such as basically you have about 37 trillion cells in your body. Each one of those cells has 6.5 billion base pairs of DNA. And that means that each one of those cells has about 2 meters of DNA.
Wow.
So if you line up all the DNA in your body from end to end, it goes between the Earth and the Sun several hundred times. So you have this huge length of DNA inside of the human body.
Wow.
And the way I try to describe what I do is, right, you've taken this 2 meters of DNA,
uh-huh,
and you've scrunched it up into the cell nucleus, which is only about 10 microns in diameter,
okay,
micrometers in diameter.
Okay.
And so you've taken all this stuff and you've smushed it into this tiny space. And, you know, anybody, at least most people, kids maybe not, because they probably don't have corded headphones anymore because everything's Bluetooth.
Sure.
But we've all put our corded headphones in our pocket in a neat fold. And then somehow when we're walking around, it just turns into a knot.
Yep.
Every single time. And so, right, I am totally fascinated by the idea that inside of each one of the cells in your body, you have this knotted DNA,
mm-hmm,
but your cell, every cell in your body has this remarkable regulatory machinery that is able to, like, extract information from this sort of knotted mess. And when I say knotted mess, that's not actually what it is, because your cells have found a way to organize the genome, mm-hmm, such that the parts it wants to access are consistently accessible, and the parts it doesn't need to access are sort of much more compacted, and it can uncompact and compact different sections based on what it wants in a particular cell on a particular day.
Okay.
And I'm absolutely fascinated by the fact that I can, right, it'll take me 5 minutes to unknot my headphones. But your cell can take this, like, 2 meters of stuff,
right,
and it can sort of perfectly extract the information that it needs at a given time. And so I'm really interested in how it does that, and how that affects sort of the technology that we're developing with with CRISPR.
So you talk about that 2 meters of DNA in every single cell. Has anyone ever actually just sort of laid it out? Because you're doing it under a microscope with some tiny sections of it. But is there a way to stretch out a piece of DNA so that you can look at it?
I am not aware of anyone actually pulling 2 meters of DNA all end to end. In fact, in your cell, it's not like perfectly end to end, right? It's like separated into chromosomes. And so the total amount of DNA you have is about the way we get the length is not necessarily by taking every piece and stretching it out. So we can do like X-ray crystallography and other really cool microscopy techniques to actually look at basically with nearly atomic resolution at like short sections of DNA.
Okay.
And from that atomic resolution, we can tell that every base pair in your DNA is approximately like 0.35 nanometers apart. And so we know how many base pairs there are, and we know the distance between each base pair. And so we can just figure out how long it is based on that. But nobody that I'm aware of has taken the DNA and actually just pulled it out from end to end across 2 meters, because it would be very hard to do that without breaking.
Sure. The
DNA.
Okay. And when you have during your studies with all of this, what were some things that you learned that actually blew your mind?
I'm trying to think of
or you
things
were really
that blew my mind that
or,
are
or really you found not, really impressive
that are not really nitty gritty details. So there's a couple things that really blew my mind. It was the reason I joined this lab, and it's because when I was told about this data when I joined the lab, I was really excited to do more experiments related to it. Mm-hmm. So when I joined the lab, we'd done some really interesting experiments with Cas9. And resolution of our method, what we can do, and this is going to get into some nitty-gritty details, so bear with me.
Okay. Well, first, before you go, what's the name of the lab?
It's Zev Bryant's lab.
Okay.
At Stanford.
Okay.
In Stanford Bioengineering.
Okay. Continue.
And so it's really cool. So I talked about these guide RNAs. That are loaded into Cas proteins. Those guide RNAs, the part that matches the DNA is 20 base pairs long. And so we design our DNA constructs with our magnetic tweezers, and we can see a Cas enzyme binds to the DNA.
Okay.
And what's really, really cool is that we use this method where we watch a bead rotate around a DNA strand at 5 kilohertz, so 5,000 frames per second. And so we're monitoring that movement so fast that we can actually, like, when this guide RNA binds to the DNA, right, it has 20 base pairs.
Okay.
We can actually see that when it binds to the DNA to open up 20 base pairs of that DNA, we can actually see that it goes through a discrete intermediate at 10 base pairs. And so it does that very quickly. This intermediate only lasts frequently on the order of like 200 milliseconds, 1 or 200 milliseconds. But because we're monitoring this so fast, right, at 5 kilohertz, we can actually see it stop in these intermediates. And by doing that, we can actually directly observe previously hypothesized things in Cas9 structures. It had been proposed that there were 10 bases of that RNA that were sort of a nucleation site for forming this binding process. And we were able to directly observe that nucleation site. And so I got really, really fascinated immediately by what kinds of information can be extracted from these really high resolution, sort of very physical methods.
So, okay, the part where you're saying that you're able to see this intermediate, is an intermediate step or an intermediate physical activity, or what is that?
It's an intermediate step.
Okay.
So it's basically, it has to go through this intermediate to fully bind. It's an intermediate in the binding process.
Okay.
So it has to go through this partial point before it fully binds. And we were able to directly see that.
And what does that look like? Because, if in my mind, the way it's happening is, here's some DNA, and here's the thing you want to plug into the DNA, and they move closer and closer and closer together, and then they plug in. But you're saying that there is an intermediate step. Is it like excreting something, or what is happening?
The intermediate sort of serves as a way for the enzyme. It's initially coming up to the DNA and being like, hey, do you match me part of the way?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do match me part of the way, I'm going to fully bind.
Okay. So it's like it's checking it out.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like it's sort of performing this little check, and then it's fully binding.
Oh.
And we were able to see this little check, and that sort of, it has a lot of like really interesting implications in sort of the physics of the enzyme, that we know where this little check is.
Uh-huh.
And if we want to like modulate the behavior of the enzyme, we might be able to like change how it performs that little check, or change how it moves on from that little checkpoint. And so it gives us information about how to modify the activity of the enzyme.
So does that mean that you've attempted, like you've been able to see when it approaches something and it's like, do you match me part of the way? Nope, don't at all. And it moves on?
We are actually in the process of doing experiments that explore that currently.
Okay.
We have it's more difficult to see, right, because it's such a quick interaction.
Sure.
That if you keep it from fully binding, that quick interaction is harder to see, because it might just say, hey, you don't match, and then like immediately leave.
Right, right.
And so we have to be really careful about how we design the experiment to see such a small, like such short-lived interactions.
Okay, now this may seem like a silly question, but like when you're working with animals, you can kind of grow attached to them, give them names and personalities and whatnot. Does that occur on the molecular level?
I'm attached to my microscope. I'm not really attached to my molecule.
Okay. So, go ahead.
I get attached to them in the moment if they look really nice, because the part about this that I have not described is that when you're doing these like sort of single molecule experiments, mm-hmm. a lot of stuff can go wrong. So finding like molecules that work feels really, really good, but it happens. So you definitely get attached in the moment. But mm-hmm. once you've taken your data with that molecule, you feel good and you go home at the end of the day.
Okay. So what then, I mean, we've talked about all the things that could be done for good, but what are some of the risks in going down this road?
I think the risks are sort of perfectly outlined by a couple different things. A couple of them are movies and books. And mm-hmm. and one of them is the guy in China who sort of jumped the gun on trying to get this to work in human children.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, this is sort of a nerd shout out. Have you seen the movie Gattaca?
Yes.
Okay, so that's sort of the risk, right? And to sort of describe this for people who haven't seen Gattaca, or another example is like the book Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
And so and this is sort of popping up more and more, especially, I think, partially because CRISPR is sort of more and more pop science.
Mm-hmm.
Like in science fiction novels and in movies, there are these societies that are often imagined where people use your genetic code and manipulation of the genetic code to like determine aptitude for certain things when you're young, or sort of more, at a more basic level, you can imagine, right? Let's say we develop CRISPR technology to the point where it's really, really good at curing disease because we know how to modify genomes very well.
Mm-hmm.
You can also imagine that at that point, we would know what genes are associated with certain physical features.
Mm-hmm.
And people might try to manipulate the physical features of themselves or children to match what they would want them to look like. You know,
sure.
Let's take something simple like eye color. Like we know the genomic loci associated with eye color. So you can imagine a really weird scenario where people would like use this technology to like change the eye color of their kid or something like that. And so I think it is going to be I think a lot of effort is going to be needed to like sit down and say and sort of draw lines about where the technology is like beneficial and where it's not beneficial. And there will probably be a gray zone, you know, like changing someone's eye color isn't like a super aggressive form of like cosmetically changing a person, but you can imagine changing hair and skin tone and like perhaps changing like other types of physical features. And I think that could be pretty damaging if people jump the gun on that too fast.
Well, what about the unintended consequences? Because sometimes in times past, they've come up with something and then down the road they go, oh, well, this has a domino effect that we weren't anticipating. What sorts of conversations are happening around that? Because you're already, like, if you're looking at, like, say, modifying your wheat crops, well, maybe that particular gene, maybe there's some advantage to having that's being bred out by making it more resistant to bugs.
Yeah, I think that's a really good and interesting point. I think there are a lot of conversations in the field about sort of unintended consequences. There's a couple forms of those, actually. And one of the main ones that I haven't touched on in this conversation that's actually a motivator for the research I do and lots of other people do, mm-hmm. is that CRISPR technology is nowhere near perfect right now.
Sure.
And what I mean by that is I described that you have these 20 bases that it uses to match to a 20-base pair site in your genome.
Mm-hmm.
It can also bind to and cleave sites that do not fully match that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a couple of mismatches in that sequence, mm-hmm. it sometimes will still bind to and cleave the strand. And so that can have immediate unintended consequences if you're accidentally cleaving the wrong site of a person's genome.
Right.
And so what's like the work I do and the work lots of people do is largely about figuring out the physical properties of these enzymes so that we can engineer them to be more perfect. And we think about down the line consequences. Yeah, that's an interesting point. You can imagine that there will be some because, right, even in crop development these days, what's really interesting is that CRISPR will actually sort of accelerate what we've already been doing in terms of crops because we've been sort of genetically engineering crops by picking the ones we like the most for, like, you know, thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think CRISPR might – I think we have to – this is one of those cases where we have to be excited about technology but not so excited that we don't take a step back and understand exactly what we're doing.
Right.
Because I think even though I can't currently describe what could be the unintended consequences down the line,
mm-hmm.
if we don't think about what those unintended consequences could be, then I think they're sort of inevitable.
Right.
And so at each step, I think it's really, I think that scientists need to take a step back and make sure that we and other people are not getting too excited about the capabilities of technology without realizing that it could do something that we did not intend it to do.
Right, like when they introduce species to different places and they go, oh, now it's overrun.
Yeah, we don't want CRISPR to turn into cane toads.
And with that, if people wanted to find out more about your research or more about the lab that you're currently working in, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, you could just look up Zev Bryant, Stanford Bioengineering, and on there you would find the lab. You'd find there are presumably pictures of the lab members and most of our recent publications. You can also go on to PubMed. So PubMed is an open way to access virtually all scientific articles from all journals.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go on there and you can download PDFs and you can look up my name or Zev's name, Zev Bryant, on those websites as well. And you could just download the available PDFs on PubMed and learn more about our research. And sort of, and more broadly, you can look, I think recently actually there are laws put in place that are removing paywalls for any science that's funded by the NIH.
Oh yeah,
Over the next, I don't know what the timeline of this is, unfortunately, but mm-hmm. over the next couple of years, anyone interested in anyone's research that's been funded by tax dollars should be able to access that on even sort of like the sort of upper end journals like Science and Nature.
That is fantastic. Well, Kevin Aris, A-R-I-S, for those of you who are going to look him up, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And you've pointed out a whole bunch of things that I never even knew. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I hope at least most of what I said was fairly understandable.
I have a woefully poor science background, and I was able to follow most of it. So, yes.
Awesome.
All right.
Good to hear.
Thank you so much.
All right, have a good one.
You too. All right. People of Earth. That was science and CRISPR and DNA and meters and beads. And it was fantastic. And we're so lucky. I want to thank the Wonderfest people because they've been providing me with Science Envoys for a few years now. And I feel like the science my interaction with science has been completely positive, and I hope it's been completely positive for you all. It's just about time for me to relinquish the microphone, but he laid out a wonderland for us, and since it's Boogie Day, you know it's going to be a boogie wonderland. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.